The Ear to Asia podcast is made available on the Jakarta Post platform under agreement between the Jakarta Post and the University of Melbourne.
Hello, I'm Sami Shah. This is Ear to Asia.
If you have a country that has a healthy legal system and active regulators who have expertise and resources, you actually can have a country that is very responsive to the risks of AI. And you see that happening in a number of countries across the region. They don't have AI laws, but they have laws about misinformation.
I don't hold a positive view on the global collaboration in AI governance, particularly given the increasing tension between the two AI superpowers and the delinking drive that has been going on for a few years. But I do hold very hopeful view about Asia. The future of AI development is in Asia. It's in the global south.
In this episode, how governments in Asia juggle the pros and cons of AI. Ear to Asia is the podcast from Asia Institute, the Asia Research Specialists at the University of Melbourne. Across Asia and beyond, national governments are confronting a new kind of policy challenge, one that's moving faster than most have ever had to legislate for. The astonishing speed of generative AI development has prompted both excitement and alarm at the highest levels of government, where the potential for economic growth and national prestige is weighed against serious questions about risk, regulation, and long-term control. In China, we've seen some of the world's earliest binding regulations on generative AI, with policymakers steering innovation to align with stated political values. Japan, by contrast, has recently pivoted towards a light-touch governance model, part of a wider shift in Asia that favors innovation-friendly oversight, even as public concerns about misinformation, data misuse, and algorithmic bias continue to mount. In other countries like India, Malaysia, and South Korea, dedicated AI bodies have been established, but concrete legislation remains elusive. So, what are Asian governments actually doing and not doing to shape the direction of this transformative technology? How are they managing the balancing act between economic ambition and ethical caution? Are emerging voluntary frameworks like the G7's Hiroshima AI process enough to build public trust and international norms, or are they just well-meaning but toothless tigers? Joining me to explore these dynamics are Professor Jeannie Patterson of the Melbourne Law School, who researches consumer and data protection law surrounding emerging digital technologies. She also serves as director of the University of Melbourne Centre for AI and Digital Ethics. And Professor Hai-Ching Yu of RMIT University's School of Media and Communication, whose work looks into the socio-political and economic impact of digital media in China, Australia, and the Asia-Pacific. She is also a chief investigator for the ARC Center of Excellence for Automated Decision-Making and Society. Welcome to Ear to Asia, Jeannie and Hai-Ching.
Hi, Sami.
Hi, Sami.
Well, let's start by looking at the concerns or even things that encourage national governments more generally amid this tsunami of generative AI development. So to what extent is the rapid progress in generative AI welcomed by those at the commanding heights of national government? Hai-Ching?
This is a very broad question. It really depends what country, what national governments you're looking at. Some governments view the AI with very positive view, thinking AI is very useful too, as you know, such as China, you know. And then there are countries that would view AI with caution, very wary of its evil aspect. So they take, you know, different approach to AI governance. So in the Chinese context, which I'm familiar with, you know, we can think about how the Chinese, I would say the Chinese government view generative AI as a significant technological advancement with both opportunities and challenges. In general, as I said, it's a good thing. Partly because, you know, China is a kind of a latecomer to this technology, but not that late compared to the internet. So the generative AI has provided China with a latecomer opportunity to catch up with the US and to drive innovation and economic growth. And secondly, I would also say, generative AI is viewed by the Chinese government as an effective tool and a geopolitical asset to strengthen China's leadership in tech, economic, military governance, and standard setting, as well as soft power projection, while it's open source, particularly open source large language models.
Ginny, when you compare China to a place like, for example, Singapore, is there the same enthusiastic embrace with certain guardrails, or is there a far more cautious approach being taken?
Well, I think that Singapore in particular, but the ASEAN group in general, are really interesting in terms of their approach. I think there's a great deal of interest in the region in the opportunities that AI can give, but a great deal of anxiety about the threats from AI, threats from third parties, misuse, misinformation, and also the uncertainties that come with reliance on that technology, particularly since that group of nations aren't building the underlying models themselves. They're largely reliant on US or China models, which increases or introduces a new vulnerability if you're going to make that the basis of a whole lot of efficiency changes in your economy.
What positive potential are they seeing in these countries? You know, is it economic or is it security defense related, technological?
I think it's all of the above. So if you look at uses of AI across the region, it's being rolled out in a variety of ways. So that sort of increasing administrative efficiency that all of us are finding at the moment from our use of generative AI, retrieving information, summarizing documents, drafting emails. The insights from data can help government policy and also companies. So with planning anything from healthcare needs to natural disaster planning to improving education or the rollout of new education initiatives, but also defense. So AI is useful for actually responding to cyber attacks. And a lot of countries in the region are making use of or want to make use of facial recognition technology to reduce terrorist and other foreign actor interference.
And then there is the threat side of things. Haixing, what threats does China perceive AI brings with it?
Well, I agree with Jeannie's points about all the above when it comes to opportunities and the challenges. Because at the Chinese term, wei ji, the term meaning challenges, but also opportunity, they all come together. We can't separate it. When it comes to generative AI, the Chinese government has always been emphasizing content moderation. It's mainly about ideological alignment. So ideological alignment, social stability has always been the core, whether it's from the internet, the so-called internet era to the platform era. And now time to talk about AI and the generative AI. It's all the logic has always been the same to ensure that whatever technologies that platforms use or tech companies implement, particularly facing the consumer side, they have to comply with national policy priorities such as adhering to the core socialist values, which we can talk about in a minute. But then social stability, the government's grip of its economic, social, and ideological development, and as well as geopolitical intention, particularly vis-à-vis the US in the AI, rivalries globally.
Does this change then from this style of governance, the constraints that governments operate under when seeking to regulate generative AI? Is that different for a liberal government versus an authoritarian government? So China, for example, are their constraints different from a place like India might have?
Yes, we can see the very different approaches to AI or technological governance. Because when we think about AI, the Chinese regulatory philosophy, as I said before, the core focus has been on ideological security and state control. That is, the AI must align with the socialist values. But when you think about the U.S., the U.S. is very much kind of market-driven, industry self-regulation approach. So innovation first, plus limited federal oversight. And then you think about the EU, of course, that takes a very different approach as well. We can see the EU's emphasis on the fundamental rights, and there's an emphasis also on risk mitigation, particularly when it comes to privacy and the bias, as we can see through EU AI Act, which was the world's first comprehensive AI law. And I don't think any other country has had that such a kind of comprehensive AI law yet. Jeannie can clarify that for me. And then another difference between China and other countries might comes to the enforcement. So having the philosophy is one thing, having the guideline is one thing, rolling out the law is another thing, but more importantly is the enforcement. China has a very strict pre-approval enforcement of those different kind of laws and regulations. So it requires security assessment before the content or the large language models or algorithms are launched, rather than the ex post enforcement that we can see in other parts of the world.
Can I jump in there? I actually don't think divide falls neatly across democratic and authoritarian governments. Obviously, the approach in China emphasizes socialist values, as Haixing has mentioned. But I think that there's also a divide between countries that are tech producing and tech importing. So the EU has famously gone in quite strongly with its AI regulation, both in terms of what we call product safety, that's ex ante regulation, making sure that the products meet certain standards before they're released in the market, and also ex post liability. EU has a wealth of law, in fact, regulating AI. But the EU famously and troublingly to the rest of the world, who perhaps has put a break on that approach, EU is not a centre of innovation in terms of generative AI. The sort of two dynamic nations there are China and the US. And I think that some of the response in the rest of the world that we're seeing now actually comes out of a concern of they want access to the technology, but they don't want to lose national control, or they've got national security concerns about being reliant on the technology. So as much as that sort of authoritarian democratic, I think there's a divide in approach according to tech producing and tech importing.
Well, if we then kind of narrow down on that a little bit more, you mentioned earlier the ASEAN countries. If we just look at some of those, is there a generalization we can make to their approach? Is it a kind of a US approach of shackles off, or are they putting in some regulatory approaches at the national level that can be seen as practical?
Well, the ASEAN has always been interesting as a regulatory entity or a grouping, because ASEAN has an ASEAN approach, which is not top-down law. It's kind of collaboration between independent nation states. So ASEAN itself has released guidance on AI, on safe and ethical AI, and then the individual countries are left to respond in the way in which they implement and respond to that guidance. But I think the common thread across those countries is, at the moment, we see a lot of soft law, which is guidance, and, as was mentioned before, almost no hard law in terms of rules applying to AI itself. But interestingly, in those countries, we're also seeing some regulatory responses to the risks of AI, and in particular, the risks of of manipulation of democratic processes. And Singapore would be the leader there. Singapore, interestingly, has an act, the Protection from Online Falsehoods and Manipulation Act, which responds to that threat of AI and online disinformation, even though they don't have an AI law and, in fact, have this sort of soft law approach of balancing innovation and safety.
I might just add on that, Sammy, now that we talk about Singapore, I actually have also been watching what Singapore is doing in the AI regulation sphere. And I really agree with Jenny on the Singapore's pragmatism. You know, it doesn't really comply or copy any other countries, whether it's the US, EU or China, actually takes its own very neutral approach. You know, I think Singapore represents Asia's rising digital pragmatism. It's trying to hedge between the two AI superpowers, but trying to ensure it has its own control and the digital sovereignty. You know, it comes down to the AI, the philosophical approach that Asian countries have taken to AI and the technology. As we can see, you know, in the West, you usually not. I'm not using it as an absolute case. AI is usually framed as a threat. People look at, you know, AI as a black box, thinking about the potential risk that needs to be regulated. But you look at across Asia in general, whether it's East Asia or Southeast Asia, which I've been looking at mostly, you can see a very different ethos dominance, very pragmatic. And you know, you think about Japan, for example, that kind of animalism and has always been its history. Machines and natures have always been like humans, having souls, part of the human society. And then you think about, you know, Confucianism and also Buddhism and, you know, all the communitarianism in the Southeast Asia, for example. You know, the kind of technology and the humans are never posed as opposite to each other. They are always helping out each other, being part of it. You know, that kind of approach, AI approach, has been also applied into how Asian countries view technology and view the role that technologies play in their society, including AI and the generative AI. That's why I think, you know, that kind of very pragmatic approach has been driven how they regulate, if they are going to regulate AI.
Well, China was the first to, or one of the first, to bring binding regulation on generative AI with its interim measures for the management of generative AI services, which came into force in mid-2023. Can you summarize for us how the regulations work and how effective they've been?
Yes, China has been trying to regulate AI since 2017, actually, you know, when it has its first AI policy. But then, you know, subsequently in the following years, we've seen a number of policies in relation to AI and also synthetic content. In 2021, we have the regulation on recommendation algorithms. And also in 2022, that's a rule on deep synthesis, which means synthetically generated content, particularly videos and audios. And then in 2023, we have seen the new rules on the generative AI. So across all the different regulations, the policies, we see common themes. I've been looking at how the policy has been made. You know, usually China has been looked at as a kind of centralizing, top-down kind of authoritarian country. As Jenny has pointed out, in this sphere, we shouldn't be talking about the binary approach. You know, we think we need to look at how policies are made involving different actors. In fact, I've been seeing how the Chinese policies have been rolled out in a very collaborative, both top-down but also bottom-up approach and an iterative approach as well. And then more importantly, they take a differentiated approach, dividing, for example, if you look at algorithms, you think about, you know, one is a content recommending algorithm. The other is like task automation algorithm. And then there are also other different kinds of algorithms. You can't have one rule that applies to all. So they have differentiated approach, or we call that tiered approach to regulate algorithms. And similarly, that applies to AI and the generative AI. So across all this, yeah, one, we have the kind of tiered differentiated approach depending on what kind of area, whether it's consumer facing or political content related stuff or not. And then there's also information control. That's the second key aspect I wanted to point out. As I said, whether it's from the internet platform or the platform era or another AI driven technological wireless era, we can see the information control has been the central goal for all across all the different policy papers. They contain many other notable provisions, of course, but the regulations, for example, the deep synthesis regulation requires the platforms to and also tech companies to register their algorithms, the recommendation algorithms, similarly with generative AI, with large language models. And in the same kind of registry body is now requiring tech companies to register their algorithms. So that kind of pre-approval, pre-assessment, security assessment before rolling out is very unique to the Chinese case. And all this, of course, that if you look at DeepSeek, for example, as an example of Chinese large language models, and then you can see the content is regulated, is censored. And then because they have to comply with the Chinese government's rule to ensure that model output are true and accurate. But who defines what is true, what is accurate, right? So that's that when it comes to that content is top down. But when it comes to the market, innovation, and particularly using open source kind of platform, joining the open source projects globally, that's a different topic.
Well, I wanted a bit of clarity on that because you mentioned DeepSeek and it's described outside of China as being open source. But is that accurate? Can you explain the difference between open weights and open source in this context?
Yeah, there has been a confusion here because, strictly speaking, DeepSeek is not open source. It's open weight. It's open weight. Open weights actually means, it's a trained parameters are made public. You can download it, you can run it, you can tweak it, you can fine-tune it. You don't know how it's made. You don't know the training code or the database. And then similarly, Meta's Llama is also can be called the open weight. I'll just give you an example. This is what I explained to my students, what's the difference between open weights and open source. Just like think about open weights as a ready-made meal. So the chef cooked the meal, brought to you, and you can add a little bit of salt, pepper to your taste. You can change the plating. I don't like your plate. I have my own plate. You don't know how it's made. You don't know what ingredients are there. But open source is different. Open source opens everything, not just the training parameters, the codes, but also the data sets. Just like HelloFresh, for example, right? You have the recipes, you have ingredients, and you are told how to cook it. You can even use the recipe to run your own restaurant, right? You can make a business out of it, but you can't do that with open weights.
You're listening to Ear to Asia from Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. And just a reminder to listeners about Asia Institute's online publication on Asia and its societies, politics and cultures. It's called the Melbourne Asia Review. It's free to read and it's open access at melbourneasiareview.edu.au. You'll find articles by some of our regular Ear to Asia guests and by many others. Plus, you can catch recent episodes of Ear to Asia at the Melbourne Asia Review website, which again you can find at melbourneasiareview.edu.au. I'm Sammy Shah, and I'm joined by Professor Haiqing Yu of RMIT University and by Professor Jeannie Patterson of the University of Melbourne. We're talking about how governments, particularly those in Asia, view and manage the rapid advance of AI technologies. Jeannie, moving away from China to the rest of Asia then, we've got recently announced massive investment in AI development by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. We've got Japan and these kind of places. If we look at some places like the Middle East, does that also come accompanied by appropriate regulatory or governance models? Do they know what they're getting into here?
Well, I think the Middle East is very keen to jump on the AI bandwagon, and we saw that with the visit from President Trump, but to Saudi Arabia. But I think we need to wait and see in that space what's going to happen, because what I'm going to say is that AI regulation is not just having a law about AI, it's having a whole regulatory apparatus with regulator expertise, which is able to oversee and respond to AI development. And I haven't seen that in the Middle East yet.
What about a place like Japan? We've discussed that as well a little bit, or particularly the Soul in the Machine. How have they approached something like regulation on AI development?
So Japan is really interesting, actually, because Japan is, as was mentioned, a country which has embraced technology, embraced the relationship between technology and humans in a quite unique and distinct way, and has gone for a famously light touch approach to regulation, voluntary risk mitigation, and we might from the West look at that and go, well, that seems very soft, but that's the way the Japanese legal system works. There's a great deal of collaboration between government, industry, and different sectors of the industry to respond to risk while also prioritizing innovation. It's quite a unique ecosystem. So I think we shouldn't see that approach as in some way ineffective. I think we see it as regionally specific, given there's a country that already has a reasonably high immersion of technology, but also is an aging population, pretty keen, I suspect, to make use of some of the things that technology can offer to responding to an aging population, actually.
Both Japan and India, though, have so far shied away from like really hardcore legislative measures.
I know, but we don't need hardcore legislative measures called an AI Act to have hardcore regulation of AI. The point is that AI is a thing that is subject to any law that applies in the nation state. So if you have a country that has, for example, good consumer protection law, good financial services law, good workplace protection law, then those laws are carrying a lot of the weight of responding to AI. Now, there may be gaps. That's one of the things Australia has been thinking about, whether our legal regime has gaps in it that necessitate an AI-specific law. It's one of the things the UK and Canada are thinking about. But if you have a country that has a healthy legal system and active regulators who have expertise and resources, you actually can have a country that is very responsive to the risks of AI. And you see that happening in a number of countries across the region. They don't have AI laws, but they have laws about misinformation. What are we most worried about with generative AI? Misinformation. So I think we need to be careful about assuming that it's only an AI law that can respond to these risks that we're talking about.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Hiroshima reporting framework as a recent international initiative? It was mentioned earlier, but I'd like to get into some of the details around it now.
Well, I guess we've been speaking about countries locally or domestically. What is China doing? What is Singapore doing? What is Japan doing? What is India doing? And recognizing that actually those countries' responses differ according to their immersion in technology, the technology they themselves are producing, and their existing legal systems. But realistically, given the global dominance of a few tech providers, the international cooperation is going to be crucial if we really do want to have a response to some of those risks of AI. And I'm talking about those sort of profound and existential risks, so issues about intellectual property and what happens to people's ownership of their creative outputs in an age of generative AI. I'm talking about disinformation. I'm talking about scams. And I'm also talking about really aggressive hacking and cyber attacks on national infrastructure. Now, all of those things happen outside nation states, and therefore a response relies on cooperation with between nation states. Now, what the Hiroshima Declaration tries to do is compile a resource about AI risk that can be used to prompt that collaboration between nation states. I personally, and I can't wait to see Haikling's response to this, I personally am pessimistic about the likelihood of international cooperation on AI risk. I just don't think we're going to get it. China and the US are in a standoff, and they're the big players in this space. What I think we'll see is either domestic initiatives like we've just heard about China, or regional initiatives. We've talked about some of the things that are happening, for example, in ASEAN. I think India's really interesting, given India's sort of talent in the engineering space, about what they'll do. I think we still need to see that. But I think we're more likely to see regional responses, notwithstanding the global aspirations of the Hiroshima document.
I'll just add a little bit on that. I don't hold a positive view on the global collaboration in AI governance, particularly given the increasing tension between the two AI superpowers and the delinking drive that has been going on for a few years. But I do hold very hopeful view about Asia. I think the future of AI development is in Asia. It's in the global south, because it's not the future of the generative AI battle. It's not about who has the best or the largest large language models. It's about innovation diffusion. It's about diffusion and application. So Asia has the largest population, but also the largest young population who are digitally savvy. And then Asia is also very open-minded. You look at across, you know, the countries in the Asia region, Asia Pacific region, young people in the region are very open-minded, and they like to try new things. And then the governments actually have been taking a very hybrid way. As I said earlier, they've taken a very pragmatic way, trying to hedge between the US-China rivalry. And then, so the future of AI, as I said, is about who are able to diffuse, innovate. It's just like, the seedling. Who are able to make sure the seeds grow vertically, not just horizontally? So the vertical AI in the region will see Asia playing a greater role. While they talk about data localization, AI sovereignty, which is, of course, they all do. But ASEAN as a very, effective regional body will play and has been playing a very important role in AI regulation. And that kind of body that countries can work together is a very good model. And I can see the regional collaboration among smaller, groups of countries, but internationally, that's probably too hard.
Ginny, going off of that pessimistic note, then how likely are things like voluntary frameworks, codes of conduct, guiding principle statements, and vaguely worded national strategy papers going to get us to a robust regulatory environment for the common good?
Well, I'm going to come back to this point about what are the risks of AI that we're worried about. And riffing off Hussing's sort of vision of a sapling able to move with the changing environment and changing winds. I think the regional approach, at least the ASEAN regional approach, and of course every country in ASEAN is distinct and unique, is perhaps to have, at the moment anyway, voluntary guidelines, but we are seeing laws on specific issues of concern, which were minted. Data sovereignty is going to be a big issue, and you can see countries responding to that concern of where is the data that's being used to both train and train the AI and also target some of the outputs of it. So data sovereignty is going to be really important. And I'm just going to reiterate, the misinformation, disinformation piece is a, is an ongoing concern of countries. Recently, KPMG and Melbourne University put out a report on trustworthy AI, and they asked people in nations across the world what they were worried about with AI, and it was actually the loss of interpersonal relationships, the loss of the human touch, and it was misinformation, disinformation, destabilising governments, and that's governments, whatever their political persuasion. So I think you're right. I think we've got a lot of highfalutin statements about ethical AI, but I think through the region there's also movement to respond to concerns about missing disinformation. That's where we may see some cooperation and regional initiatives, for example, on watermarking or standards about identifying synthetic content. And I think that, and protecting children would be another one actually, from harmful content. So I think we may see movement on those sort of issues rather than a global governance framework or an overarching governance framework. That's not a bad solution actually, because as I keep saying, if you've got strong national laws in other areas, then those will pick up a lot of the slack. What I would be looking for is more investment actually in regulatory expertise. So I think one of the things we're starting to see is AI safety authorities or AI commissions, which don't have legal lawmaking power, but are able to provide really useful and profound guidance to government and regulators and lawmakers on AI risk.
Is there a lesson to be learned here from the climate change regulation or the kind of stuttering approach to that, the you know, pretenses towards international cooperation that never really implemented in any practical strategic way? Can governments try to see from the failures of that successes that might be applied to AI regulation?
Well, I would say the problem with climate change and the reason why we've had so little action is it's far away. People keep saying, oh, well, it's not happening now. And yet the initiatives and the interventions that we need to respond to climate change are now. In fact, they were probably 10, 20 years ago, where I think for governments, I suspect governments are very aware of the risks to them of AI. The benefits, but also the risks. So that's why I think we're seeing action in that space of online safety misinformation combined with Hussing's innovative, flexible, unique approach. And I'm sure she has more to say on this.
Of course, you know, as you said, you know, when it comes to climate change, you know, we haven't seen the effective international collaboration or coordination. But when it comes to smaller, I wouldn't say smaller, when we come to vertical problems, specific problems like misinformation, we have seen international collaboration. There are international governing bodies for misinformation and for fact checkers, for example. And Taiwan, you know, I have colleagues doing research in Taiwan about misinformation, and there's a vibrant civil society there, and civil society organizations have been very actively involved with regional but also international fact-checking organizations. And that kind of coordination, ground up civil society living kind of initiative, will be where we see international collaboration happening. And then, I also wanted to add, when it comes to Asia, when I was talking about Asia would be the future of the AI battleground, also because, you know, as Jeannie pointed out, you know, Asia is so diverse. Even the ASEAN countries, you know, have such huge diversity in terms of language, culture, and also, you know, the national context. But we also see, because of the diversity and also developmental need, we see the drive for AI for development in those countries. Of course, you know, we see the international tech companies and the government, national and international NGOs being active in the region. At the same time, we've seen regional, local actors, including the startups, be playing an increasing role in rolling out their local language specific large language models that serve local need. And that kind of lightweight but localized models that target to specific cultural and infrastructural realities is where innovations happen. And that kind of innovation is where the regional collaboration happen.
So final question to both of you then, Jeannie, starting with you. How do governments best perform the balancing act of getting aboard the AI bandwagon then while maintaining a level of regulatory control that serves a national and public interest? Is the model the China one where you put in the strict censorship up at the start of the system and then create a kind of open source slash open weight version, or the Singapore model, which seems to have got more of a balanced approach, or then there's the India and Japan approach, which is fairly hands-off? Which one is the most practical for many Asian countries?
Oh, if I could answer that, I'd have a lot of money, I suspect, because I'd be off working for a consulting company. But I actually think the answer has been just been given to us, which is the ASEAN countries and the Asian region, the countries are proudly diverse. And one of the initiatives I'd agree with that's really interesting is this idea of sovereign language models, which support and buttress those regional strengths, and also kind of loosen the hold of, I think, the international tech companies to some extent. But more globally, I would say that the issue for most countries is that the technology is changing really fast. And one of the problems with writing laws is the law, hard law, is just that. It's hard. It's not necessarily adaptive. So this sort of softly, softly approach on one view looks weak, but on another view responds to change in technology. And I'll say again, what countries who want to retain control of technology need, and I think there are risks in the rollout of technology. I'm not saying there aren't risks. I think there are genuine risks to human thriving, to democratic systems. But if governments want to retain oversight or influence, they need to embrace that community inclusive approach, one, and two, they need to invest in training, literacy, expertise in AI so that their regulators, their lawmakers, the community have a say in what is happening, and have the capacity to draw the line where the technology is not operating in the national interest.
Haixing?
Okay, just to reiterate, there's no good or bad at this stage. As I pointed out earlier, that Asia has taken a very pragmatic approach to governance, technological governance. Today we're talking about AI. Tomorrow, we don't know. We're talking about AI agent, Gen AI agent, and then we don't know what else comes along the way around the corner, because technological sphere is changing so fast. Every week there's something new, right? So the kind of flexible, literate, and the collaborative approach that Asian countries have taken will ensure that they are able to keep up with the changes, and also the localized approach also will ensure that they retain data, but also digital sovereignty, instead of catering to the US or the Chinese, tech hegemony. And I would also want to add, the open source movement will be an opportunity for lots of middle to lower income countries in the region. Because, to develop, powerful large language models requires compute, lots of compute data, compute power, data, but also talent. And then not many of these countries have all three. And then there are only two countries who can do this, right? US and China. But what would the rest of the world do? Of course, there are still opportunities. Asia has the largest number of data centers, for example, in the world. And then, so data center is the physical infrastructure for generative AI. And then that's only just one example when we look at AI governance from the infrastructural perspective. And then how they govern the data centers to ensure not just data localization, but also in terms of energy reservation. That has environmental impact, right? So that, it's not just, we're talking about technology, we also talk about climate change. When you think about the physical infrastructure, the material infrastructure of AI. So lots of Asian countries are not rolling out specific AI act or anything like that, because you have to look at the whole thing from a holistic perspective, which is, what Asian countries are doing. They are good at looking things from a holistic perspective rather than just looking at, one slice of the cake. They look at the whole cake to say, what do I do with this whole cake?
Our guests have been Professor Jeannie Patterson of the Melbourne Law School and Director of the University of Melbourne Centre for AI and Digital Ethics, and Professor Haiqing Yu of RMIT University's School of Media and Communication and Chief Investigator for the ARC Centre of Excellence for Automated Decision Making and Society. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Sammy. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for a fabulous conversation, Sammy.
Ear to Asia is brought to you by Asia Institute of the University of Melbourne, Australia. You can find more information about this and all our other episodes at the Asia Institute website. Be sure to keep up with every episode of Ear to Asia by following us on the Apple Podcasts app, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate and review it. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. And please help us by spreading the word on your socials. This episode was recorded on the 11th of June, 2025. Producers were Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Param of Profactual.com. Ear to Asia is licensed under Creative Commons, copyright 2025, the University of Melbourne. I'm Sammy Shah. Thanks for your company.